This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
We could see now that for many young people, democracy is just like an empty sound. So I keep hearing all the time at my presentations, very often from young people, what's the difference, United States or China? So it's a new race now, it's a high-tech race. So what's wrong if China wins? I mean, why should we bother about, you know, about the ideology and about free market and about democracy? And I thought it would be very important to go back and just to look at the history of this great country and the history of the free world and to explain so why these values are indispensable and how to actually bring these values to the 21st century, how to connect them.
So I feel like what's great about your essay and these ideas is that for you, it's not some academic theory. You grew up in authoritarian regime and you
totalitarian
and you were greatly affected by it. And again, just to take it a little more personal level, in your first World Chess Championship match with Karpov, it was often portrayed as Karpov being a representative of the communist Soviet regime and you being portrayed as sort of the young, up-and-coming, potentially dissident challenger.
And rightly so.
Are you ready? All right. Rolling. So excited once again to have Garry Kasparov. I have to start off the interview this way. He's former best chess player in history, was world chess champion for 16 years, was the number one ranked chess player when you retired, right? You were still number one.
Yes.
Yeah, for 20 years, you were number one in the world. I've personally gone through hundreds of your games, I feel like. It's always weird sitting across the table from you because I've had your games on the table in front of me so many hours of my life studying them. But now we're here to talk about something different. We're talking about your this new collection of essays. You have one essay, but you helped organize this collection. It's called The Fight for Liberty, Defending Democracy in the Age of Trump. There's many great essays in here. Yours is one of them. It's divided up into first principles about essentially what is a liberal democracy, threats, where you wrote an essay, and solutions. But we were just talking before the podcast began, what you really wanted to call the book.
Yeah, the original title that we wanted to put on the cover was Federalist Papers 2.0. I think this title could reflect the whole idea of the book. It's a bit self-promoting.
Why would you say that's self-promoting?
Let me start with the organization Renew Democracy Initiative that I helped to form almost 2 years ago, in the beginning of 2017. As the many similar projects, it was a reaction to Trump's elections and the recognition that something was wrong. And it's not just because Trump was elected, but the fact is that you had two candidates from major parties having a combined negative rating of 120%. Yeah. And also that the whole process, I don't want to repeat, you know, just to follow Trump saying it was rigged, but definitely something was wrong with the system that could end up with Trump-Hillary elections. And also Trump's phenomena was not, you know, unique for America. We could see the similar effects in Europe and the polarization that helped nationalist forces to take the front seat in local politics.
So to unpack that a little bit, the world and Yuval Harari brings this up in Sapiens. The world's been sort of heading towards globalism, open trade, friendly relations, more democracy. But you're saying that this nationalist trend has been in part Russia's underpinning it, in part because as long as there's dissent and these countries are not working together, he has more economic power and other power.
Yeah, but it's not just nationalist trend. It's more like Spain in 1936. You have nationalists on one side and socialists on the other side. So this is, you could see that the very radical factions that typically, you know, just belong to the fringes and never had much to say for national politics, they all of a sudden, you know, were running the show. And it's, again, it's not America only. It's, you can look at the UK. When Brexit campaign that succeeded, at least in the referendum, I still hope that there's a chance it will be reversed. It brought Jeremy Corbyn, a backbencher socialist, who was sitting there for 30 years doing nothing, and all of a sudden he's a leader of a Labour Party, and who knows, could be the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. You see Germany with Die Linke, the former communists on one side, and the rise of neo-Nazis, AfD, on the other side. You look at France, Marie Le Pen, everybody talks about her, but also Mélenchon, far-left candidate, made nearly 20% in the first ballot of presidential elections. So combined, two radical groups got more than 40% in the first ballot of the elections.
So looking at that, why is every government going to extremes? Where's the middle?
That's a problem. The middle the center has been decimated, because it seems to me that the mainstream politicians, they failed to respond to obvious challenges. It's a long story, but you know, we should probably just look at the immediate outcome of this polarization. Because it's if we do nothing now, if we don't find the right arguments and a new concept, vision for the future, we are facing a serious threat that these polarized forces will tear apart democratic institutions. Because on one side you have a threat to liberal values that comes from the far right, but on the other side you have a threat to market economy coming from far left, and combined, they could have such a powerful political hurricane that could can wipe out all the democratic constructions that have been erected over the last couple of hundred years.
I missed the second half of your intro, which is that, you know, after you retired from chess, you attempted to run for president of Russia. You were in protest. You were arrested and beaten by the Russian police. You finally left Russia rather than go in to be investigated. What kind of triggered it's like this transformation from, and it was all along. I mean, you know, back even in the 80s, you were sort of representative of this new presence against the old Soviet order, but what sort of triggered the change for you to fight so much for this?
As you just mentioned, you know, I was quite active politically even in the late 80s during Gorbachev's perestroika, and I thought at that time that as a very young world champion, I could help to rally people behind this newly born democratic movement, and I had big expectations for my country, for Russia. I thought that, you know, from one point, Russia could play a vital role in changing the world and making it better. Alas, you know, it didn't work out the way I thought it could, and for me and millions of my compatriots was a great disappointment. So when KGB came back to power with Vladimir Putin in the year 2000, and I've been warning ever since that while Vladimir Putin was our problem, it would be everybody's problem. As with every dictator, I read enough history books to know that when dictator runs out of political opposition and enemies inside his own country, he goes elsewhere because he needs new challenges. He has to defy other powers.
And what's his goal?
To stay in power. It's not just necessarily, you know, a traditional imperialistic policy, you know, just to conquer other countries. It's not a traditional totalitarianism of the 20th century, like you had Stalin or Hitler. There's no ideology behind Vladimir Putin. It's more like a mafia. It's all about staying in power, and to stay in power, you have to prove every day that you are indispensable.
So Vladimir Putin would say to you, there is an ideology. The U.S. keeps abandoning these, you know, there are these revolutions. Hopefully democratic regimes take over. Then the U.S. pulls out and abandons the new regimes, and Russia goes in to help.
Yeah, but
that's their supposed ideology.
That's an ideology. It's opportunism. But, you know, it's just, you know, let me try to go back, you know, just because it's this. I think we moved to geopolitics, and I want to go back to the domestic issues and back to the book, and then we'll cover Vladimir Putin. Don't worry. I'm not going to be shy, you know, talking about Vladimir Putin and his cronies and agents and lobbyists around the world, including this country, of course. So going back to the beginning of 2017, as I said, there were many initiatives, And I got a few of my friends, you know, some of them, I call them the refugees from the Wall Street Journal, like Brett Stevens or Max Boot, those who just, it's conservative intellectuals who couldn't stand, you know, Donald Trump and so-called never Trumpers. And they thought that, you know, that something had to be done. So just you have to preserve the ideas that they believed in, you know, and just they left, of course, GOP, and they were looking for some new, you know, new engagement. So there were some moderate Democrats here in New York. So we got together and we came up with the idea of Renew Democracy Initiative, how to bring together intellectuals from both sides and to find sort of to find a foundation for renewed democracy, because we could see now that for many young people, I mean, democracy is just like an empty sound. So what is that? So why it's good? So I keep hearing all the time at my presentations, very often from young people. So what's the difference, United States or China? So it's a new race now. It's more computerized race. It's a high tech race. So what's wrong if China wins? I mean, why should we bother about, you know, about the ideology and about free market and about democracy? Does it, you know, offer us any bright future? And I thought it would be very important actually to go back and just to look at the history of this great country and the history of the free world and to explain so why these values are indispensable. And how to actually bring these values to the 21st century, how to connect them. So that was the idea of the book. That's why we thought about Federalist Papers 2.0, because it's an attempt to actually to bring this the work of the founding fathers to the 21st century and to show the connection. That's history. It's not a science. It's not math or physics. But I believe that in history, 2 + 2 will end up with four, but it's not, you know, may not be straightforward. It could be a little bit crooked, but at the end of the day, it's still four. And what we know from history, that is the only free world was able to create this wealth and just to move the world forward. And when you look at innovations, breakthrough innovations, let me emphasize, all came from the free world. And there were many challenges to the free world, whether it came from communism or from fascism, but it all ended up with the free world dominating. And it's important for us to understand why. And this book hopefully, you know, could help readers, especially young readers, to understand so how the past, present, and the future connected.
So I would say in your essay, you brought up a point that kind of changed my mind on something. So in general, I don't think, or I haven't thought, the U.S. should get involved in too many, you know, wars or regime changes or whatever. But you bring up the fact that democracies don't go to war against each other. And
never, by the way.
Right. And so that almost from a financial and a peace perspective, it's better for the United States to get involved early to make these things.
It's not about that you have a choice. I mean, when we say globalization, we think globalization comes up only, you know, just it's with trade or with, you know, tourism. Now, globalization means everything. I mean, bad guys also use globalization, you know, to spread their influence. And it means that, you know, whatever happens in Syria, whatever happens in Indonesia, whatever happens in Africa, somehow can affect you because we all are connected. So this is the
okay, but how could something in Syria affect me? Let's just play it out.
Perfect. Okay, let's not talk about you but just about democracy as a whole.
Okay.
Syria. So there was an uprising against Assad. As in every other Arab country during Arab Spring, it was very secular at the beginning. So Assad, you know, cracked on this. So, and there was the military resistance, but obviously, you know, when you just put, you know, when you force peaceful protests into the military resistance, you have radical elements. Naturally, in Syria, it ended up with more Islamic radicals actually, you know, jumping into the resistance and creating the pocket of this military confrontation that were filled with all sorts of bad guys coming from different places. So Assad was doomed. And in 2013, being desperate, he used chemical weapons. So Obama made a very strong statement saying, Assad, I had to go. And in 2013, he had a very good chance of actually, you know, fulfilling his promise, using force, at that time very limited force, just, you know, basically just to destroy Syrian military aviation, so still the Assad's capacity to use chemicals, and also it will be a very powerful message. Probably few missiles could do the job, and could Syria come into chaos? Maybe, but We should look at the outcome of inaction, because Obama wavered. He was waiting for the free for other countries to join him. Nobody wanted to do anything. Europeans looked for Syria as it's far away. Especially Germans, they said no involvement. Fine, vacuum doesn't stay for too long. America walked away. Putin came in. And Putin immediately realized that's not ideology. Let me emphasize, going back to the beginning of our conversation, he's not an opportunist. So he saw a chance not only to prop up Assad, which is very important, because American president said Assad must go. Putin said, Assad would stay. And it was a chance for him to prove, both to his cronies in Russia, but also to his lobbyists and agents around the world, that he was so powerful that he could defy American president and to prop up that such a monster like Assad. But he also saw another opportunity by using chemical weapons, but also carpet bombing Syrian cities like Aleppo. He could start pushing refugees. The refugees had no other way to go but to Turkey and then to Europe. And what's happened with this millions of refugees, you know, fleeing into Europe, it helped Putin's natural allies, far right. Now, the outcome of these exodus of refugees from Syria to Europe, especially to Germany, where Merkel received, she probably had no choice. So she didn't want to interfere in Syria. She had to help refugees in Germany. She accepted 1 million Syrian refugees. The result, 94 neo-Nazis in German Bundestag. AfD came out of nothing. First time in history, the neo-Nazi party could succeed without any economic hardship. Typically, you know, the fascism is on the rise when people are suffering, unemployment, long lines. Germany's economy is thriving. But all of a sudden, AfD, it's now the third, probably soon the second largest party in Germany. One electoral success after another. The only reason, refugees. So that's it. How it's connected? This is this way. And by the way, having, you know, 94 neo-Nazis, again, third largest faction in German parliament, and it keeps rising in the local elections in Germany, means that NATO is getting weaker. So that's why it helps Putin to spread his influence. And eventually, you know, it affects you also. Because even if you don't have refugees in your country, it's a card that can be played. There were no Syrian refugees in the UK. But Brexit, one of the ideas, look at the refugees. They're not coming to UK. Most of the people who are coming to UK, they typically, immigrants from former British Empire. Nothing to do with Europe or Syria. But again, the image, the refugees. And in America, Trump also played this card. The Syrian refugees is just the number is just, it's so meager. It's totally irrelevant when you look at number of immigrants in America. But again, the fact is that you saw the pictures, and it's easy to convey the message to the public that, look, the refugees are coming. Probably the pictures are taken from Macedonian border, from Hungarian border, just somewhere in Europe. But the fact is that the refugees are coming. It's helped people like Trump and forces that aligning with him in Europe, and of course Vladimir Putin, to spread chaos around the world.
So what does Putin gain by this destabilization, though? Like how does Russia gain? How does Russia gain in prominence?
Okay, you mix two things. You said okay. Putin or Russia. Russia doesn't gain. Russia is losing, because any country that is run by a dictator, you know, is losing historically. So it's because then you have to recover from the years and years of lost opportunities and destroyed economy and endemic corruption and of course wars that could turn even your closest friends, like for instance Ukrainians, into your enemies for generations. But for Putin doesn't care. It's he runs Russia like a mafia boss. It's all about guaranteeing those who are loyal to him full remuneration, so just an ability to steal in Russia, to keep money elsewhere in the free world. And now, you know, he recognizes that since economy is no longer playing into his hands and the whole overall situation looks shaky, he needs to show his strengths by defying the free world. And the fact is that he could win. That's what is being presented by Russian propaganda. Brexit. You look at the Putin's allies in Europe. You look at Italy, where just, you know, pro-Putin parties, they form the government. So, and you look around Europe, and especially now the United States, where Putin pretended for some reasons that Trump was his creation, and there were high expectations of Russian propaganda that Trump could lift sanctions and play by Putin's tune.
So when you look at, like, when you were rising up, you know, you had Brezhnev and kind of old Soviet politics, and compare that with Putin. Do you see similarities? Do you see differences? They had an ideology.
No, argue. There are differences, and that's why I think it's just it took time for the free world to recognize the threat, because it was not it didn't look like the Soviet Union. I think it's also psychologically it's more difficult to understand that you have an enemy if you don't have the like demarcation line. We had the Berlin Wall, and it was a physical border, so free and unfree world. Now there's no Berlin Wall, and there are no walls. Though somebody wants to build another, but it's the division is not geographical. It's not just by walls, but it's by the split within the society. It's sometimes within families. Putin's strength is that he doesn't have to sell you an ideology, because when you sell an ideology like a communist ideology or fascist ideology or any ideology, you have to actually argue for it. Because you know, you tell me, I want to nationalize all the factories. I want to nationalize land and means of production. I'm saying, no, it didn't work out. So we started a debate. A lot of people, you know, they could actually move away because they could see that your position is vulnerable. Now, Putin's policy is far more effective. He doesn't sell you any ideology. Basically, he sells you doubts. That's why I always call him merchant of doubt. And it's very, it's far more successful and more effective, because basically saying, no, it doesn't work. Look, look at the problems. And people look at the problems. So it's like, for instance, you want to come up with a new product on the market. So say toothpaste. And your product is lousy. So you can try to pretend that your product is good, but you basically could say, oh, look at this one. Look at Colgate. Look at this one. They all have problems. Try something new. You don't say whether it's good or bad. It's just something new. And Putin's propaganda machine, that is probably the best funded in the world, there are billions and billions of dollars being spent both domestically and outside of Russia, keeps telling people that everything is relative. You don't know the truth. It's one of my most popular tweets was about exhausting critical thinking. So it's not about trying to tell you think this way, but it's about just demolishing your ability to think critically. And by the way, it's so easy now because there's only one way to tell the truth, and there are zillions of ways to lie, especially if you have access to so many channels of social media.
So two questions from that. One is, you think that kind of technique is hitting U.S. politics? Obviously, you do to some or to a great extent. The other is, Russia's the 10th greatest economic power right now in terms of GDP. It's 15 times smaller than the U.S. Why is he getting so much influence? Like, who cares about Russia? And I know that might be the most naive question in the world, but
it's the right premises. Mm-hmm. So Russia is economically weak. Russia is militarily weak. Okay, set aside the nukes, of course. So it's a pale shadow of the Soviet Union. When you just look at the country that Harry Truman faced, or JFK, or Ronald Reagan, Russia today doesn't have the same capacity militarily or economically, or even politically. When you look just around the world and the coalition that Soviet Union could build in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and today's Putin's Russia is sort of pariah state, but it just its political influence has been greatly reduced. But If you are at a war, you can easily lose the war, even if you have overwhelming advantage, if you don't recognize you are at war. Putin's main advantage is he is fighting the United States. He is fighting the free world. And if you just don't believe me, just find someone who speaks Russian and just asks him or her to spend one day listening to Putin's state TV. It's 24/7 anti-American propaganda. And it was not seized even at a time when Obama was desperately trying to build the bridges and looked for a set and just tried to sort of find common ground with Putin, because Putin defying America is one of the key elements of his domestic propaganda to demonstrate his strengths, he can spend enough money for hybrid wars. Yes, he doesn't have the same army just to confront NATO. He doesn't have to, but he has enough, military capacity to help Assad and just to take over Syria, because America walks away. So it's not that difficult to win the war when the opposite side, which is much more powerful, doesn't want even to recognize it because it sounds bad.
Well, and you point out, and the other essayists here point out, that America always getting involved in these other countries is not necessarily, you know, there's a debate. What is our democratic principles? Like, do we get involved in other regimes or is that imperialist? Do we try to enforce change when it's not necessarily on the surface our battle? The American public sort of leans isolationist. We don't want to necessarily go to war. We saw Vietnam, it was a disaster. We weren't very good at Afghanistan, it's a disaster. Iraq's a disaster. So it's unclear what the results are for us.
Yeah, but let's start with this with the current position at the geopolitical chessboard. So you can just get out of everywhere. So you can say, okay, we don't care. So we just we want to live in a world where just it's being ruled by goodwill of other people. Will it happen? So you left. You're leaving Syria now, and basically, America abandoned Syria even just before Trump.
So Syria, the Arab Spring, we abandoned Egypt.
And are you better off now?
No.
Are you better off?
No, but it was hard to justify staying.
But are you better off now? This 500,000 people dead in Syria, 13 million refugees. The neo-Nazis in Europe are on the rise. That's a result of you walking away. So, by the way, you said Afghanistan was a failure. But 9/11, happened after 8 years of America doing nothing. Mm. So God forbid there was no second 9/11. Probably one of the reasons, because the bad guys have been busy fighting American troops elsewhere. Yes, every American soldier is dying, overseas, bad news. What about 3,000 people, more than 3,000 people killed in one day? It's more than the entire Japanese fleet killed at Pearl Harbor.
But you could argue it's because Americans funded Osama bin Laden to fight the Russians in Afghanistan back in the day in the early 90s.
Yeah, but look, it's early 80s, by the way.
Early 80s.
We're talking about early 80s. And this was not Osama bin Laden. It was a Cold War. Do we want to go how far back we want to go? To Stalin, to Hitler, to FDR, to William Jennings Bryan, McKinley, Lincoln. So things are connected. But after 1991, the situation in the world has changed dramatically. There was no more Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. America was a dominant political, economic, and military force. So in 1992, basically, America could reshape the world the way it wanted without even shooting one bullet, without sending a soldier, just basically pushing one way or another. So what's happened? Oh, by the way, one of the big achievements of Clinton administration was to make sure Ukraine would be denuclearized. In 1994, under American pressure, Ukraine gave up its entire nuclear arsenal to Russia. I understand the rationale behind this idea.
Well, why they do that?
No, because it's from the American perspective, from the UK, because John Major was also co-signatory of this so-called Budapest Memorandum, it was a good move to make sure that the Soviet nukes that have been spread in four former Soviet republics, Russia proper, Ukraine, and a little bit in Belarus and Kazakhstan, they could be concentrated in one place, in Russia only. Because otherwise, you have just, the threat of proliferation. Mm. So it was good. But the Budapest Memorandum guaranteed Ukraine territorial integrity in exchange for Ukraine giving up its nukes. By the way, Ukraine's nukes, the combined number was bigger than China, UK, and France combined. 2,000 nuclear warheads. Mm. That's what Ukraine gave to Russia. And US president with British prime minister and with Russian president signed this guarantee. People say today, it was non-binding. Yes, it's non-binding, but you understand if Ukraine kept even part of these nukes, Russia would never go to Crimea. So it's the, and in 90, from 1992 to year 2000, America failed to offer a vision. So what's the new concept of the world? Because, if you don't offer any idea, so how to live in the future, somebody else will. And 2001, America was attacked. It's the worst attack in American history. And it's not an attack that could be prepared for one day or 2 days. Many years took many years to prepare. And obviously, it was a result that America missed quite a few opportunities to eliminate bin Laden because, again, I understand the rationale. People don't want to be involved in conflicts. The language of deterrence is a rough one. The language of appeasement is a soft one.
So your point is, if they had a coherent or cohesive vision that might have overridden the desire to not be involved in these conflicts. So what would have been, and you talk about this here, and particularly in solutions, but what would be that vision that would have kept the world going?
First, you know, it's again, we should recognize a simple fact. There are different countries in the world run by, you know, by different people and different political systems. And many of them, actually majority of them, do not share our values. So more than 60% of people today live in the countries that run by authoritarian or totalitarian regimes. And by the way, we are facing now unprecedented streak of democracy losing its ground. For 13 consecutive years, if you look at the freedom index provided by Freedom House, whether it's political, economic, or freedom of speech, it's on decline. And as by the way, that's also probably the result of America not being growing more isolationist and thinking that you can stay away and you can be protected by two oceans. But you know, you live in a world that is just, you know, it's if you walk away, your enemies will not, you know, leave you. In peace, because for them, confronting America is the main justification of their political existence. What else they can offer to people? Putin has nothing to offer. Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, you look at all these organizations, the confrontation is the only justification for them to survive politically and to have followers. Because the entire concept of the dictators or terrorist groups is based on the fact that they are opposing the free world. So that's why this confrontation is inevitable. And for those who say, we don't want America to be global policemen. Yes, fine. Now, what about life without policemen on the beat? So we see the outcome. And I'm not telling that, you know, you just have to start, you know, sending troops all over the place, but you just need a concept and a vision. So how to try to reduce the influence of the bad guys? Because, you know, more people being killed, more blood being spilled, more refugees being pushed away, and it creates more chaos. And chaos, by the way, it's counterproductive for prosperity. Europe and the United States, the free world, lived in peace for 75 since 1945, so for more than 7 decades. And that's, I believe, one of the reasons why people, you know, could enjoy, you know, the beauty of life, and they could see the steady improvement of their lives, and all this the technology worked in out, you know, for us just to make our lives more entertaining. The average lifespan, you know, keeps growing. So we are enjoying lives without recognizing that we have to pay price for that. And now we also have the forces that are trying just to push us back, and unless we fight, it's, you know, we'll never succeed. And for those who said, oh, Putin, you know, could do limited damage, yes. It's, you know, reminds me of my conversation with Bill Maher. So 3 years ago, when more than 3 years ago, when in his studio, when I was trying to raise the awareness about Putin's threat, and he was very dismissive, as many in this country, saying, okay, it's not a big deal, and he said, quote unquote, wake me up when he takes over Poland. Okay, I jumped on my chair saying, you know, the last time we heard this phrase or similar phrase was the beginning of the greatest disaster in human history, so the World War II. And of course, after 2016, Bill has changed his mind, his views, and he's now going after Putin, after Trump. And at one point, you know, I couldn't help teasing him on my Twitter saying, okay, it seemed that Putin decided to skip over Poland and went straight to Wisconsin. So for those who thought that
a lot of Polish people there too.
Yeah. It's for those who thought that Putin would stay, you know, in Syria, in its so-called near abroad, in the former Soviet republics, or in Eastern Europe. I mean, they underestimated the fact that, I mean, what could stop Putin of trying to actually influence American elections? He did it in Europe in many countries. And dictators, I said, dictators never ask why. It's always why not. And the outcome, you could see it. So, and you think it's the end of the story? No, it's not the end of the story, because, you know, it's whatever happens with Trump in the remaining 2 years, or, you know, whatever his time is left for him in the office. I mean, he could do tons of damage for this country, but it's not just damage for America. It's a damage for the free world. Because the moment President of the United States, undermines the alliances, insults American allies, and basically, you know, walks away from traditional values by ignoring them or just or blasting them, and at the same time praising dictators around the world. That's, you know, that's a damage that cannot be simply repaired, you know, just by electing the right man next you know, at next elections. Because for many people in the world, you know, it's just it would take time to recover confidence in the United States.
So one of the solutions mentioned in your book of essays is that more countries need to be involved potentially in NATO, like a Japan, like an Israel, like some of these countries that have liberal democracies, not just in Europe, but outside. And that would give that feeling of coalition. I mean, the big criticism against W going into Afghanistan and Iraq is there was no real coalition. And that's probably why Obama backed out of Syria. And again, that's what Trump is sort of bringing up as well. What's the chances that maybe some of these liberal democracies join in the fight so Americans don't feel like we are the only policemen there?
But look, it's you know, coalitions are important, but every coalition needs a leader. So this is, so far, you know, there's no American leadership as it used to be in during the Cold War, or, you know, just going back to the World War II, America played also a vital role of defeating Nazism. I think it's getting more and more complicated, because look what's happening in Syria now. Kurds fought bravely against ISIS. They helped to defeat ISIS, almost, you know, just to destroy ISIS. 8,000 Kurdish men died fighting this battle. Now America is walking away, leaving Kurds, you know, between hammer and a hot place. We have Assad and ISIS in one place. And then you have Erdogan, who just, you know, is dreaming about having another bloodbath for Kurds. So how can you convince these people that America, you know, is going to be serious? So this is, it's not about one-off. I think it's about vision. It's about coming back with an idea. So what do we want to achieve? Well, now, our world in 5, in 10, in 15 years. Late John McCain talked about League of Democracy, and I fancied this idea. Just, you know, just I came up with something similar at the same time. It's just bringing together democracies in the world. So, I mean, recognizing the fact that today United Nations is nothing else but catwalk for dictators, because it's just it's a lip service that they pay for UN resolutions, but at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's for them to promote their agenda, and once every year to gather in New York and to brag about their rule, United Nations, that has been formed in 1945 to preserve world peace and to make sure that Soviet Union and United States would not enter it's the nuclear Armageddon. It's this organization was not built to solve conflicts. It was more like freezing conflicts. And now we're relying on the organization that is just, it's spreading corruption, and both political and maybe not only political. And it's you cannot have any meaningful document there. I mean, just you look at the UN Human Rights Council with countries like Saudi Arabia, Cuba, Venezuela. It's an absolute joke. So this commission had last year 21 resolutions condemning Israel, and one resolution condemning Syria, one for North Korea, one for Cuba or Venezuela. So it's all about non-democratic countries having very powerful say in the organization that supposedly should help us to improve world for better.
So what's the first step? What's the first step that someone should do, that let's say Trump, the president, should do, that the United States should do, or some country should do? What's the first step to start?
The first step, going back to America, it's still, the first step is here. So because America is the leader of the free world. So this is, if you don't recover, so the America's strengths, first domestic strengths and international strengths, nothing will happen. So you cannot expect Europe, so badly divided Europe, to take a lead. Or, you know, you can talk about Japan, Australia, maybe Brazil. So this is Mexico, Canada. But at the end of the day, it's about the United States. So reinventing itself as a global leader with a vision for the world. And that's why, you know, we had our new organization and this book. So just explaining that is the process of so rekindling the spirit of democracy must start here.
And also the fear that you just brought up, the connecting the dots between what's happening and Brexit and Germany and France and the U.S., I think, you know, everybody's motivated a little bit by fear. And I think that goes hand in hand with vision.
Yeah, but it's also, yeah, it's what we discussed, you know, just beginning of our conversation is that political center has been decimated. So it's not that, you know, just we want to preserve status quo. Status quo is just, you know, it's not going to work for young people because they always want to have something dynamic. But it's about, you know, rebuilding the foundation for stable democracy that could inspire people to do great things. Like, for instance, you know, conquering the space. So I think it's very important that we help public to recover the spirit of exploration, spirit of innovations, and also engagement. So one of the most quoted phrases from presidential inaugurals, it's most likely it's JFK's, ask not what your country can do for you. Can you imagine any politician today saying that? Just it's the end of your political career because, you know, that's exactly what people want to hear. No, I want to know what country can do for me. So it's not other way around. So when you go back to the 60s, you know, there was just, you know, country was rallying behind the space program because it was important. And people even didn't recognize that the side effect of the space program could actually have tremendous positive effect for their lives. Mm. Like GPS, ARPANET, that later, you know, was transferred in internet. So it's very important that, you know, the nation can move forward by just, you know, seeing, so having some confidence in the future. I think now just the effect is the opposite. So people are afraid of the future. So that's why they always look for defensive options. And that's why you can have demagogues, whether coming from the far right or from far left, that are just trying to rally support, telling people that we had something in the past, something great that we're missing, whether it's, you know, crazy nationalist ideas or utopian socialist ideas that never worked.
So I feel like a lot of this, what's great about your essay and these ideas is that for you, it's not some academic theory. You grew up in authoritarian regime, and you
totalitarian.
And you were greatly affected by it. Like, and again, just to take it a little more personal level, in your first World Chess Championship match with Karpov, it was often portrayed as Karpov being a representative of the communist Soviet regime, and you being portrayed as sort of the young, up and coming, potentially dissident challenger.
And rightly so.
Rightly so, although you were a member of the Communist Party because you had to be the system.
But how
true was that betrayal, though, of you know, that dichotomy of communism versus the young youth?
It's not about...
For you, in that match.
Don't forget, you know, which is when I played Karpov, my first match, it was you can say the Soviet Union was pregnant with changes because Gorbachev was just, you know, on the political rise.
But nobody knew that then. I mean, it was just in the beginning.
84 we already knew that is just, you know, this the herontocratic regime, you know, was just about to fall because you needed just biologically, you needed new people just to take over. And there were expectations. There again, it was not writing on the wall. But still, you know, I remember when I won and I was 22. And I was half Armenian, half Jewish, coming from the deep south of the Soviet Union versus Anatoly Karpov, Russian, representing the establishment. For many people, and I hear even today when I meet these people, you know, around the world, even in this country, so they say, oh, for us it was, you know, like a signal. If Karpov could be beaten by Garry Kasparov, that's a chance for country to change. Because Russia, as many non-democratic countries, is a country of symbols, symbolism. So that's why the Karpov loss and my victory, that was so symbolic. I even couldn't understand the importance of the symbolism. But now, you know, 33 years later, so I could feel that, you know, that was my big contribution by simply winning at the chessboard to raise the, not even confidence, but to give a hope for millions and millions and millions of people in the Soviet Union that wanted to change our country. Great hope that, it could happen.
And it did. I mean, I was in 11th grade and even we felt it here, you know, you winning in that way. And, you know, and this segues a little, but you had a very interesting strategy in the very first match. You kind of realized what was happening and you extended a long period of draws. You made it so that every game was ending in a draw as much as possible until he tired out and then the match was canceled.
It's not about the tired out. Look, he got tired out, but the match was closed not because I made draws, but because I began winning. So I won three games. So
after how many draws were there though?
No, after game 9, I was trailing 4-0. So I made 17 draws. So from game 10 to game 26. So I lost game 27, was 5-0, and he needed only one win to sort of to wipe me out, so to win the match, because that's that the rules were just 6 wins.
Were you scared?
Draws were not covered. Okay, yeah, I was not scared, you know. So I knew I was doomed, but I wanted to fight. And while making all these draws, I learned a lot. It's like, you know, just my training session. So I'm making draws, you know, I got, you know, more and more engaged. So I learned more about Karpov and about, you know, the way he played. And I think he just, you know, he thought it would be almost automatic. So he, you know, he failed to win game 31. He was close. I won game 32, which was, you know, just for me, big relief. At least, you know, I won one game. And then Karpov tried very hard. For the next 16 games, he tried very hard. He couldn't win a single game. I won two games, 47 and 48. And then Soviet authorities, they recognized that the match was already, you know, it's in question. I was still trailing 5-3, but it's just, you know, the momentum was on my side and I looked much stronger, much fresher and very energetic. So, yeah, like, I kind of just, I could feel blood. So it's the, going back to these matches, I think that's what's important is that you understand so that you're in trouble and you have to adjust your strategy.
You have to do kind of a meta thinking about
it. Exactly. It's very important that you have a right strategy again too, but you also have a goal. So this is, you know what you want, you know, just long term, but it's very important to survive now. So sometimes, you know, just, you know, you can have very great ideas about the future. You can start making long-term plans. But if you get mated, going back to chessboard, you know, in two moves, nothing is going to happen. So sometimes you just have to make sure that, you know, you stay in the game. So, and again, I think that this match was very important for me as not just to become world champion, but also to... It sharpened my character because I realized that, you know, this no situation is desperate. I mean, if I could survive losing 5-0 when my opponent needed only one win to finish me off, and my opponent was the world champion, and I survived and came back 6 months later and beat him and became world champion, so no situation is desperate. So because the odds at that moment, they were the worst one can imagine.
So I'm going to fast forward to the Carlsen-Karuna match of last year. But I promise I will tie it all together and say...
How many of your listeners know who Carlsen-Karuna?
No, but what's interesting is, you know, Carlsen basically, it almost as if he arranged for the match, the initial part of the match to end in a draw, so they move into the blitz games where he was significantly better than Fabiano. And you were critical of that, saying it was kind of, he should have fought harder in that original match. But why wasn't it good for him to do the meta thinking where he was even with Fabiano in tournament play, but he knew he could crush him at blitz play?
Let's not misinterpret my words. So is this, I think I was very clear saying that the strategy was good for Magnus and bad for chess. I mean, Magnus was there to play the world championship match and to defend his title under the rules. But it was pretty bad impression on general public, especially in game 12, the last game of the match, where Magnus had a tremendous position, serious advantage. He could push. And he decided to offer a draw because he knew that then it would go to rapid chess and blitz chess where he was much stronger than Caruana, which, by the way, I've been saying it from game one. I said it is, though 6-6 technically is a tie and then they move to the tie breaks, 6-6 is Magnus' victory. So that's why Caruana had to do absolutely everything to win in classical chess, not to leave everything for the rapid or blitz. And Magnus' decision was practical from his perspective, but the way it was viewed by millions of people who watch the game, and I could I also watch the game, and I could hear people almost cursing because they just didn't understand how the strongest player in the world could walk away after reaching out such a great position. And they just don't want to hear the arguments about world championship match. It's all about winning. I mean, I understand these arguments. And that's why I say it was good for Magnus. But we just have to recognize that the match played a very dubious role for promoting the game of chess, since, you know, a lot of people got really frustrated.
Because they wanted to see what that 12th game maybe would have looked
like. Exactly. It's there's always a contradiction. The World Championship match is not about playing your, you know, the most beautiful chess. It's about winning. So people just, you know, and I also said it, you know, people don't remember, you know, they keep forgetting. So the whole scenario of the game or a match, all they remember the result. So for instance, you know, I have been watching soccer World Cups since 1970 when I was seven. And in 1970, Brazil crushed Italy in the final 4-1. Beautiful match. Pelé scoring goal just in the beginning of the match. Phenomenal. In 1994, Brazil faced Italy in this country, in another World Cup. Brazil won in penalty shootouts after a scoreless draw 0-0. So at the end of the day, it's a two World Cups of Brazil. Who remembers now? So that's 1970 was a beautiful match, and 1994 was just, you know, very dull game.
Pelé became one of the most famous people on the planet.
Yes, exactly. But still, in 1994, it was another. You know, people say, "Oh, Brazil won five World Cups, five, and one of them was 1970. One was in 1994." So it's. I think that's Magnus' view is as who cares today? I won another match, so I'm the world champion. It's my fourth title. So because he keeps counting. So he says, Gary had six, now I want to get seven, so good luck. So, but that's the way he thinks, and I, as a professional player, I cannot blame him for that. All just, you know, I worry is about the image of the game, because it's people still expect a lot from these matches, especially now when you have so many people watching them online. It's not like, you know, when I played Karpov, you had, you know, maybe couple of thousand people in a big Moscow hall, and then, you know, then you had maybe some radio stations, but people couldn't watch it live. Now, just, you know, you can watch it on your phone. So, and it's not just to watch, you can actually follow the computer line, so you can understand exactly what's happening. So that's why sometimes you are even more experienced than the world champion, because you have such, you know, such great help coming from Engine, which is much stronger than Magnus Carlsen.
So bringing it back to this, what's you've done so many things, you've pursued so many different avenues, and you have fought for a long time for democracy around the world, democracy in Russia, you know, to the point of attempting to run for president. What's next for you? How do you continue this?
So you keep repeating
fight?
Run for president. I mean, it's I don't want people just to get a wrong picture about Putin's Russia. Running for president in Russia means, you know, making a statement, because you cannot get into the ballot, you cannot raise money, you cannot have political rallies.
You couldn't rent the room to
exactly. No,
to
it's, just, it's all about, you know, it's all about demonstrating that Putin's Russia was anything but democratic. And by the way, it was 2007. Those years I called vegetarian, because for protesting against Putin, you could end up in jail for 5 or 10 days. Now it will be 5 or 10 years.
If you went back, would you be in trouble, you think?
The trouble is just it's understatement. So, but I don't want to find out whether it will be just arrest or worse. Look, most of my friends and allies who marched with me and were part of the protest movement, they're either in exile as myself, in jail, or dead like Boris Nemtsov. I mean, it's a dictatorship eliminates any potential threat, even sometimes imaginary threat to its rule inside Russia. And as we know, it's Putin's reach is not limited by Russia. So many of his political opponents, you know, they were hunted and killed even outside of our country.
So what, as you continue this fight, which you're obviously doing with this book, what's the next steps for you? What do you think are the next steps in general?
It's somehow, you know, I'm using my experience, you know, from coalition building in Russia, because I thought it would be important to bring people, you know, just from different political quarters to fight against Putin's regime and just having a simple goal to fight for free and fair elections, saying, okay, we have many differences, but let's leave the differences aside and debate them when or if we're elected to the parliament. And this movement was, you know, quite a threat for the regime. That's why they used harsh methods to destroy it, and it couldn't succeed. One of the reasons also that the world didn't want Putin and Putin's regime to go. It's just everybody looked for status quo, for so-called stability, flexibility, as once Obama said, in relations to Putin. Now in America, I had the same feeling that it's very important for people from both sides of the political aisle to recognize that there's a threat that everything could end up as a disaster if you have a choice between Trump and someone coming from the far left. It's very important that it's not just being involved in the political process now, but actually explaining why we should rebuild the system. I mean, I have quite strong views about the overall reform, because I think that's, you know, it's with all due respect to the great achievements of the founding fathers and the system that they designed that had been working for nearly two and a half centuries. You know, every mechanism gets rusty, and we could see that now. That's the certain elements of the system, they have to be revisited. It's I think the electoral college is a problem. It's a long term. It's not going to happen now, but it's just. I think that have been established there, like the Supreme Court nominations. Having your life tenure, it's, you know, things are different. It's in 1800. What was the average lifespan? 40 something, and maybe for upper class 50. Now people can live 80 plus. So that's this and. Second Amendment of the Constitution. So how many people you could kill in 2 minutes in 1787? Maybe one. Now you could, you know, in 2 minutes you can put down 500 people. So it's I'm not telling you that we have to change all those things, but it's very important we start looking at every element of this political system and recognizing that somehow instead of offering us stability, they just, you know, they create more problems. Two-party system just doesn't work anymore because parties grew too big. And it's when parties are growing too big and you have gerrymandering, so what happens at every local elections is that you have to take care of the challenge, primary challenge coming either from the right or from the left. So which means, you know, you're pushing the political life, you know, further to the fringes. And it's, you know, it inevitably has an effect to the national politics. There's so many problems, but, you know, we have to go back and just recognize that while America is facing all these challenges, when you look at American history or history of Europe or just history of the world, it's still, you know, it's the most advanced democratic country in the world. Whatever people say, you know, pointing out the problems. That's why I strongly oppose those from the right or from the left saying the system is rigged. As I just said in the beginning, I don't want this to say it's not rigged. It's imperfect. But we don't live in a world, we're not in heaven. So everything is relative. So when you look at the American history, and that was one of the ideas of the book, is there are many bumps there. But it's about improving your social life, your political life. There are steady improvements. Yes, there were many things in the past, but they have been gradually pushed aside. We still have a lot of people in this country that just don't believe, you know, in the things that we think are just, you know, they're very natural and it's just our traditional values. But more and more people are joining the majority that is pushing for the future. It's, you know, while we're trying to improve life here and to help to rebuild the free world and just, you know, bring back its... The belief that it's the only way for humanity to move forward, I think it's important for us to learn from history. And I'm quite happy just to be part of this project because it somehow unites people, you know, that's typically we're opposing each other, fighting for important things, you know, like gun control, abortion rights, but just recognizing that right now it's not about these issues, but it's about preserving the foundation of the Republic, preserving the framework, First Amendment, don't forget, that will help us to actually continue this healthy debate in the future without, you know, us just being held hostages by radicals on either left or right.
Well, and I think, you know, for me, I read the book. I felt like some beliefs I held dear were starting to crumble as I read this because I realized the importance of, again, from this book, from your essay in particular, the importance of, oh, there is benefit to being involved in certain situations that it's hard to exactly see what the outcomes are, but the outcome is important. And I didn't quite understand that before. And I think the other thing is it's helpful to develop your skepticism. Like, even if we believe in the primary principles, to take a look at the Second Amendment, to take a look at the way the Electoral College is, to take a look at the way the Supreme Court is structured and say, okay, the foundation is still there, but we may need to look at where it might have gotten rusty. And I think that skepticism, which is, this book is almost a book about skepticism in some way, in a meta way. And I think that's an encouraging thing. But I highly recommend the book because it gave me a really much deeper, rather than just this is what's happening now, it gave me a real deep understanding of how the dots are connected around the world and the potential dangers to democracies. And thank you for writing it and putting it together and starting this conversation. I'm glad we've been able to talk again.
Thank you so for inviting me. And again, that's the bottom line is that globalization means that we're all connected. And pretending that you could isolate yourself from the rest of the world is just, it's a great disservice for this country, for you, for your family, for your friends, because we are, you know, we cannot, you know, separate ourselves from what's happening in the world. And somehow, even maybe you think it's a mystery, but we're being affected. And we should be proactive. Maybe just it's about my style, chess style, my dynamic styles. But I believe that, you know, it's a time where we just, you know, proactive position is the only way to shape the world. Because if you don't want to be proactive, you will be subject for manipulations. And it's very important. Just, you know, just a thought, quick thought about it, is just the social media. We keep saying social media, social media, social media. And just we almost, I think we've forgotten that the original concept was social network. So, and you see the difference between social network, where we are just, you know, we are newsmakers. So we are connected. And social media, where all of a sudden we are just, you know, subjects for manipulations.
Right, just like passively receiving media.
Exactly. So I think it's very important for everybody to recognize that he or she could play a very important role. But it's about being engaged. I remember when people, you know, after 2016 elections, they kept talking about 80,000 votes that decided the elections. It's a disaster. Hillary won the popular vote in the country. And it's all over again. And I kept saying the problem was not 80,000 people who just, you know, decided the elections. The biggest problem is 90 million people who didn't vote. So I think it's very important, and that's one of the ideas of the book, is actually to give people the sense of that's of this urgency. You have to be engaged. You can change things. And for me, someone who was born and raised in a communist country and someone who fought Putin's regime for the rights to vote and just to have free and fair elections, seeing people who are just, you know, are not involved, and by having these rights, birth rights to participate in democracy, it makes me feel really annoyed. And I want them just to get back to the original ideas, that empowered them at first place.
But don't you think many people are getting engaged by just this mindless fighting? I'm on this side, you're on that side, so we hate each other. And there's this mindless arguing all day long on social media.
You know, look, it's I think it's inevitable, but it's still, you know, for me, if you have more people being engaged, I think they will start inevitably. Many of them, some of them will stay, you know, fighting these petty fights. But many of them will start, you know, just reading serious books, serious articles. Because, you know, it's people who just have a lot of self-respect. So this is, not all of them will be wasting their time for just, you know, throwing mud at each other. So they'll try to understand what's happening. I still believe in the wisdom of the crowd. But you need bigger crowd. We need bigger numbers. Because the moment you have more people engaged, so this is you could see that the radicals losing, because they represent a small part of our society, whether on the right or on the left. But they are very loud. They're motivated. They have an idea. So that's why it's very important to fight them with this wisdom of the crowd, with a massive population that it's just, you know, just doesn't want things to go one way or another, just radical left or right. But still, you know, it's too passive. And I hope that, you know, this people will recover the passion for innovation, passion for exploration, and passion for, you know, personal engagement in the future.
Well, again, I think they could start learning that passion reading this book, Fight for Liberty, Defending Democracy in the Age of Trump. This was put together by you, but has essays from Ted Koppel's a familiar name, Tyler Cowen's a friend of mine, a friend of the podcast, so many other great people, Richard North Patterson, Nathan Sharansky, so many great essayists, so many great essays. Not everybody's saying the same thing, which is a great point, is that skepticism can come together to form a kind of, not quite consensus, but a belief that we need to move forward, and here's how. And this is a great book describing it. So thanks once again for everything you do, and for winning in 1985. I played through every game as it was happening.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.